Okay, guys, welcome to the first Mental Health Aware Yoga lecture. The focus for this lecture is an introduction to Mental Health Aware Yoga. Let's start with the Peace Chant, otherwise known as the Student Teacher Chant, led by Saraswati, Vasudevan, and friends. I invite you to join in the chant with us.
Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahanau Bhunaktu Sahaviryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
So this is me. As you know, I'm a clinical psychologist, a yoga teacher trainer, and a certified IREST meditation teacher. I'm a lot of other things as well, but perhaps these are the most relevant to why we're here today. So let's turn now to looking at why mental health aware yoga is so important. Why are we here? Nearly half of the population has experienced a diagnosable mental illness at some point in their life. That's a lot, right? So this varies across countries and survey methods, but it's true in Australia, which is 45%, the United Kingdom, which is 43.4%, and the USA, which is 46.4%. One in five people have experienced a diagnosable mental illness in the past 12 months. That's a significant number of people, right? If you think of the number of students in your yoga class, depending on how big your class is, at least one or two or three statistically will have experienced a diagnosable mental illness in the past year. So this research that we're talking about here only takes into consideration individuals who meet diagnostic criteria for mental illness. It doesn't include those who are feeling low or who are struggling or who don't ask for help. Therefore, it's likely that the rate of individuals experiencing mental health challenges is considerably higher. Mental health issues are now considered to be one of the main causes of overall disease burden worldwide. And major depression is considered to be the second leading cause of disability worldwide. It's safe to say that mental illness is a pretty common experience. In a landmark study in Australia in 2005, Stephen Penman surveyed 3,832 Australian yoga students and teachers. I was one of them. And he found that 58.4% of yoga students began yoga to reduce stress and anxiety. That's over half of students coming to yoga for mental health reasons. And 79.4% of yoga students continued to practice yoga to reduce stress and anxiety. That's over three quarters of yoga students continuing their yoga practice for the mental health reasons. He suggested that mental health may be the primary health reason that people practice yoga. Another little part of his research that I thought was interesting that I thought I'd share with you here is that while only 19% of yoga students initially saw yoga as a spiritual practice, this increased to 43% once they'd started practicing. So students may develop an interest in the deeper spiritual side of yoga eventually, but that doesn't seem to be the predominant reason that they're coming to yoga initially. Okay. So what is clear is that millions of people worldwide are affected by mental health, whether it's a diagnosable mental illness, subclinical levels, or if they're supporting someone who is experiencing mental illness, which, you know, can be a really challenging experience in itself. And significant numbers of people with mental health issues are coming to yoga for support with these mental health challenges. As yoga teachers, we really need to know how to support them. So I'm really glad you're here. So given that so many people are coming to yoga for support with their mental health, what role do yoga teachers have to play? Yoga teachers are not therapists. We're trained to teach yoga, not to provide counseling or give any kind of medical advice. However, yoga teachers are what Jared Egan calls informal helpers. So informal helpers are professionals like teachers, doctors, managers, lawyers, et cetera, who are trained in their specific field, yet are still called on to support people through times of crisis or distress. Yoga practices and the safe container that yoga teachers hold in their classes can be nourishing and supportive for students. And so it's not uncommon for students to come to yoga for these reasons. And it's also not uncommon for students to start to open up about their challenges in the safe space that's created in the class and with their teacher. We're going to touch more on scope of practice and referring to other health professionals later in the course, but for now, it's safe to say that as yoga teachers, it's likely that you will be called on to be of support, and it's important to have the skills to be able to do this. Egan points out that helpers need to be wise rather than smart, and that part of their job is to impart some of their wisdom, however indirectly, to their clients, or in our case, students. So Egan lists the following characteristics of wisdom. He says, wisdom includes self-knowledge and maturity, knowledge of life's obligations and goals, an understanding of cultural conditioning, the guts to admit mistakes and the sense to learn from others, a psychological and human understanding of others, an insight into human interaction, the ability to see through situations, the ability to understand the meaning of events, tolerance for ambiguity and the ability to work with it, being uncomfortable with messy and ill-structured cases, and by cases he means individuals, an understanding of the messiness of human beings, openness to events that don't fit comfortably into logical or traditional categories, the ability to frame a problem so that it's workable, the ability to reframe information, avoidance of stereotypes, holistic thinking, open-mindedness, contextual thinking, meta-thinking, or the ability to think about thinking and become aware of being aware, the ability to see relationships among diverse factors, the ability to spot flaws in reasoning, intuition, the refusal to let experience become a liability through the creation of blind spots, the ability to take the long view of a problem, the ability to blend seemingly antithetical helping roles, being one who cares and understands, while also being one who challenges and frustrates, and an understanding of the spiritual dimensions of life. Some of these skills are likely to be part of a yoga teacher's training and lived experience. Others will be learned during this course, and some come simply from living life in all its joys and challenges. So another way to look at the role of a yoga teacher in mental health is the ability to create a transformational space. In his wonderful book, Yoga and the Quest for the True Self, Stephen Cope shares his journey with yoga from a busy, stressed out psychotherapist in the wake of a relationship breakup to a 4-month yoga retreat at Kripalu that he never left. In the yoga retreat, Stephen found a place where transformation happened. Our yoga classes can too act as a transformational space for our students. In his book, The Yoga and the Quest for the True Self, Stephen highlights the qualities of an authentic transformational space, and they include, they create a quality of refuge. So transformational spaces are temporary safe havens from the ordinary demands of the world. They're places where we're able to lay down the demands of knowing who we are and what we're doing, and are allowed or even encouraged to cultivate an I don't know mind. They're spaces where we are accepted just as we are. Stephen highlights that spaces where students are encouraged to develop an I don't know mind and then given a whole new system of beliefs to take on only complicates the process and doesn't qualify as a transformational space. As being seen and accepted for who we are can feel particularly vulnerable entry into a transformational space can be protected by rituals that create a special zone of safety and signify stepping out of the everydayness of our regular lives. This acknowledges that a process of rebirth is happening and requires protection. They create a safety through constancy in relationship. So in a transformational space, a special relationship forms between the teacher or mentor and the student. In this relationship, the teacher is constant, reliable, non-abandoning, and non-reactive to the student. The student is allowed to reveal themselves just as they are, including the parts of themselves that are already owned and acknowledged, and those parts that are hidden or disowned. In this zone of safety, the student is able to experience their limitations and their magnificence, meeting everything that arises within them within the context of a constant and present emotional availability and support. This enables maturation and growth. Transformational spaces encourage creative and out-of-the-box thinking. They provide a space for students to try on new ways of being, of reorganizing parts of themselves, and are encouraged to experience feelings and sensations that were previously denied. The process is seen to be more important than the outcome, and daily life is viewed as a playground in which to act out the drama of human life and development. During the period of transformation, certain transitional objects like people, places, and things become charged with meaning and for a time become symbols of the transformation itself. A teddy bear or a blanket from childhood is that classic transitional object. In his book, Stephen shared how as a child, his favorite blue and white checkered blanket helped him to transition from the developmentally appropriate but nevertheless terrifying realization that he was a separate human being. This blanket that he clung to and then eventually gave up was part of the process of growing up. So a transitional object, can be anything that is constant and reliable and supports the student during this period of transformation. So it could be the teacher, it could be the room that the teachings happen in, it could be a favorite book, it could be a chant, or it could be a specific practice. The transitional objects are seen as vehicles that set into motion and support the student during transformation. They are not confused with the goal itself. As Stephen so eloquently puts it, and I'm going to quote him here, the glory, as it were, is given to human nature or to God or to soul and not to the transformational environment itself or to the idiosyncratic transitional objects. There is heightened awareness that it is our inherent potential humanness that is made sacred, not the vehicles that bring these potentials into realization. Okay, so it's important that the teacher is not seen to be a deity or seen as a perfect, all-knowing authority, as this undermines the potential for the space to be truly transformational. Even brilliant, enlightened, and charismatic teachers need to be seen not as gods, but as guides and mentors. It's normal that the relationship might be highly charged and surrounded with love and respect, but it's important that even great teachers are seen as transitional, and ultimately, we must set them free and be ourselves. Transformational spaces provide us with a way of finding out who we are. So transformational environments avoid telling us who we are and instead support us to find out who we are for ourselves. So this happens through providing techniques and practices that give us full, direct, and immediate experiences of ourselves rather than preconceived ideas of a particular belief or faith. Transformational spaces are connected with truth, clear-sightedness, and exploring reality directly, not with promoting specific doctrines and beliefs. The transformational space does not have to be perfect. The psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott stated, "A good enough mother will do, and so too will a good enough teacher or mentor do too." An effective transformational space is one where it is made explicit that they are supporting and facilitating what is already within the individual, and it only needs to be encouraged in order to manifest. There's danger anytime a teacher, a mentor, or a community sees themselves as having the perfect way, and this is a sure sign that their reality is impaired. While the language in these pseudo-transformational environments can be intoxicating and seductive, especially during times of uncertainty, as promises of perfection, enlightenment, and absolute safety are made, they actually promote delusion and a kind of grandiosity that is counterproductive to maturation. They are open to and support other paths of development. So a healthy transformational space does not claim exclusive rights to our time, energy, and money. And instead, they're open to and promote any learning or self-expressive processes that support our path to development. Okay, so let's take a look at how yoga helps with mental health. The mechanisms behind how yoga affects mental health are no doubt complex. However, I believe that quite simply, it might just come down to connection. So connection with ourself and others. Self-regulation. So being able to regulate our internal experience. Embodiment. So being present and at home in the body. Mindfulness. So I like Jon Kabat-Zinn's definition of mindfulness. He says, mindfulness is paying attention in a particular way on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. Self-knowledge and acceptance, so getting to know and accept ourselves just as we are. Self-care and compassion, just the act of doing something for ourselves, whether it's yoga or something else, helps with mental health. So this is something that Dr. Rick Hansen and I discussed in our interview on my podcast, A Grateful Life. If you're interested, I've put the link below so you can check it out. Exercise. Okay, this is a bit controversial. You know, some people would argue that yoga is not exercise. But the way that I see it, yoga often does involve moving the body, doesn't always, but parts of it can involve moving the body, and therefore yoga can be considered a kind of exercise to greater or lesser degrees depending on how you're practicing. And the research shows that exercise is very important for mental health. Okay, so I want to show you a couple of videos now about components of these. The first video is about connection. Just coming to a yoga class and connecting with others can be incredibly supportive and powerful. So take a look at this video on depression, anxiety, loneliness, and connection by my friends over at Uplift Connect. They interviewed Johan Hari, the author of the book Lost Connections, Uncovering the Real Causes of Depression and the Unexpected Solutions.
We are the loneliest society there has ever been. There's a study that asks Americans, how many close friends do you have who you could call on in a crisis? And when they started doing it years ago, the most common answer was 5. Today, the most common answer is none. I learned a lot about how this is affecting us from a man called Professor John Cacioppo, who was at the University of Chicago, one of the leading experts in the world about loneliness. He proved a few things. First thing he proved is that for a human being acutely lonely is as bad for your health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. If you become really lonely, that releases as much of the stress hormone cortisol as if you are punched in the face by a stranger. This is a terrible thing for us. And I asked Professor Cacioppo, well, why is it? Why is it so devastating for us? And he said to me, why do you and I exist? One of the reasons we exist is because our ancestors on the savannas of Africa were really good at one thing. They weren't faster than the animals they took down a lot of the time. They weren't bigger than the animals they took down a lot of the time, but they were much better at banding together into tribes and cooperating. Just like bees evolved to need a hive, humans evolved to need a tribe. And we are the first human beings ever to try to live without tribes. It's making us feel terrible. Picture a bee that decided it was going to live apart from the hive. It would go crazy. It would start acting in a way that was completely haywire. Now imagine telling that bee that it was feeling that way just because of a pollen imbalance in its brain, right? You can see how that would be a bizarre way of thinking. So what I wanted to think about is, given that loneliness is driving this epidemic of depression, anxiety, it's one of the 9 factors I write about in my book, Lost Connections, What's the antidepressant for that, right? What do we do about that? And one of the heroes of my book, Lost Connections, is an amazing man called Dr. Sam Everington. And Sam was really uncomfortable because as a GP, he had loads of patients coming to him who were depressed and anxious. Like me, he's not opposed to chemical antidepressants. But he could see that they were taking the edge off for some people, but they weren't solving the problem for most of his patients. So he decided to pioneer a different approach. One day, a woman came to see him called Lisa Cunningham, who I got to know quite well. Sam said to Lisa, "Don't worry, I'll carry on giving you these drugs. I'm also going to prescribe something else. I'm going to prescribe for you to take part in a group." First meeting they had, Lisa was literally physically sick with anxiety. But a couple of things happened. The first thing was Lisa noticed they had something to talk about that wasn't how shit they felt, right? Normally with depressed and anxious people, we either drug them or we give them places to talk about their distress, both of which have value. But in this case, they decided they were going to learn gardening. They decided they were going to get their fingers in the soil. There's a lot of evidence that exposure to the natural world is a really powerful antidepressant. The other thing that happened is, as the weeks and months went by, they started to form a tribe. They started to get to know and care about each other. And they did what human beings do when we form tribes. They started to solve each other's problems. One of the guys in the group had been thrown out of his home and was sleeping on the bus. Everyone else was like, "Of course you're depressed and anxious if you're sleeping on a bus, right?" They started to pressure the local authority to get him a home. They succeeded. It was the first time they'd done something for someone else in years. It made them feel great. The way Lisa put it to me, as the garden began to bloom, we began to bloom. There was a study in Norway of a very similar program that found it was more than twice as effective as chemical antidepressants. I think for a simple reason, it was dealing with some of the reasons, the disconnection from other people, the disconnection from the natural world. The most effective ways of dealing with depression and anxiety are the ones that deal with the reasons why we feel so bad in the first place.
Ah, interesting, isn't it? Okay, let's take a look now at a video by Kripalu in the US. They interviewed Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, one of the foremost experts and teachers in trauma, who is also a big advocate for yoga in trauma recovery.
Trauma is about heartbreak and gut-wrenching feelings. It's not about thoughts. It really is about your body getting stuck in a state of sensations that are basically intolerable. So that's sort of different from how people out there talk about trauma. It's like they say it's about a memory that needs to be digested. I don't agree with that. It's about how your body gets stuck in being frozen or in heartache and gut-wrenching feelings, and you need to really reclaim your body is a very central issue of overcoming trauma. Emotions are about physical sensations. So you feel joy in your chest. You feel joy in your movements. When your heart is broken, you feel it over here. When your gut is wrenched, you feel it over here. So emotions are really about physical sensations. Trauma is about having unbearable physical sensations. Right? So you can go to your psychologist and yak about what has happened to you, but the core issue is not what happened to you, but the fact that your body got stuck in heartbreak and gut wrench. And so somehow you need to be helped to learn to re-own your body. We did a study on the immune system and trauma and saw that basically when people get traumatized, their immune system starts overreacting and starts attacking themselves. And I think that was a very good metaphor for people's bodies getting stuck in a state of terror. So I've explored many different methods of dealing with trauma. I found that yoga has had the best reception. When you're a traumatized person, it feels like nothing will ever change. When you do yoga, you notice you can put yourself in some damn uncomfortable pose, and before too long, it's going to be over. And you get that sense of time, which is a very important thing in helping to overcome trauma, because sucky things happen to people all the time. And the way you move through life, you say, okay, today it sucks, But tomorrow is not a day. So you have this sense of time that allows you to have that perspective. When you get traumatized, that perspective of this too shall pass disappears. And so reestablishing that sense of time, which yoga does so well, is another very important part of what yoga can do for people. Yoga really helps people to really contain themselves and to safely experience their bodies. It makes it possible for people to feel things that they may be very afraid to feel. And so that's just really much of my attraction to yoga, is understanding that when you get traumatized, you don't really want to feel what you feel and know what you know. And that really is part of the, it's very at the core of the problem. And then how yoga really makes it safe for you to experience yourself, even though what you experience may not be all that great. And one thing I particularly like about good yoga teachers, for example, you'll say, hold this pose for 5 breaths. And the first breath you say, I'm not going to do this, or you say, I'll try it one time. And then you know that everything is going to come to an end. And this very, very nice contained way that yoga allows you to do things that you ordinarily wouldn't want to do or dare to do. You say, no, just try it for a few breaths. And then it comes to an end. You say, wow, I did it. And those are the sort of elements about yoga that I deeply appreciate. And so what we do in the weekend workshops, it give people an introduction to how you might safely experience yourself. But for some people, that can be quite frightening to actually be asked to breathe and to notice what comes up when you just sit on your butt and to breathe. So very simple things sometimes prove to be quite challenging. What's also important to know, as like our research showed, that a steady yoga practice for a traumatized person is more effective than any medication that anybody has studied. It doesn't mean that you should not be taking medications, but overall, statistically speaking, yoga in the long range has more beneficial effects than medications. But that doesn't mean that doing yoga is going to make you immediately feel better. What we find actually is that when people start doing yoga, starting to feel your body may bring up feelings of helplessness, terror, etc., etc. So part of what yoga can do for you, and having a good yoga teacher, is to help you, to give you the courage to begin to face your sensations. And we give people an intimation in our workshop of that experience.
Oh, so fascinating, isn't it? We know that yoga is so helpful for our well-being and health, and I love it when the experts agree too. Okay. So before we finish up this introductory lecture, I want to walk you through the 6 pillars of mental health or yoga. We're going to be working through these 6 pillars throughout the training. So these are the 6 pillars here. The first one is Western psychology. So in this first pillar of mental health or yoga, we're going to look at mental health through the lens of Western psychology. We're going to be looking at depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, trauma disorders, as well as stress and comorbidity. And then we're going to turn to yoga psychology. So in this second pillar, we'll be exploring the foundations of yoga psychology, including Patanjali's model of yoga psychology, depression, anxiety, and the gunas, yoga as cultivating sattva. We're going to be looking at koshas, kleshas, samskara, and non-dualism. In the third pillar, we'll go through the importance of and how to create a safe container, including the sacred role of the teacher, professional boundaries and ethics, creating a safe and nourishing environment for your students, touch and hands-on assists, helping without rescuing, scope of practice, when to refer, confidentiality, presence, the vinyasa of welcoming and farewelling your students, partner work, mentoring, social media and promotion, self-practice, self-care and self-inquiry, and also what to do when ethical dilemmas arise. There's a lot there. In the fourth pillar, we're going to explore therapeutic skills for yoga teachers, including meeting your students where they are, creating an individualized practice, moving together, skillful language, effective listening, and unconditional positive regard. In the fifth pillar, we're going to explore traditional and evidence-based yogic practices for mental health, including yoga and mental health research, assessing but not diagnosing your students, asana, pranayama, meditation, contraindications, so what not to do, compassionate, non-judgmental witnessing presence, sankalpa bhavana, and teaching themes. And then in the sixth pillar of mental health aware yoga, we'll be discussing what to do in a mental health crisis. Okay, let's dive in. Thank you so much for joining me for this, and I look forward to seeing you over in the next section.